Here in about 3 hours, and for you to speak. I want to start with whether you ever wondered why the statue of Lady Justice, the one holding the scales, has a blindfold. It is where the term blind justice comes from, and why she has a blindfold is that no matter what happens outside this courtroom, where in certain arenas there are people with power and influence who affect what happens in the world, here in this courtroom, in these four walls, in this jury box, Lady Justice is blind, and no matter who you are, no one should be above the law, even police officers. And no matter who you are, even if you're a homeless camp, no one should be beneath the protection of them. That's the charge I put on your hearts as you go forward in this particular case. We've talked about and heard from the witness stand that society gives police officers a tremendous amount of power. We give them guns, not just sidearms, but long guns, and we give them a license to kill. And as you heard from the witness stand, that license is limited, and strictly limited by the society itself, to certain particular rules that they have to follow. And who decides what the rules are? It is not the police department that decides. If there was a rogue police department that said, we want to start shooting people of a particular color or people of a particular race or a particular religion, the society would say that cannot happen. That cannot happen. The jury gets to decide what is reasonable. You have heard a huge difference from the different witnesses, the two experts, about where that line should be as far as when police officers can shoot someone. But it is not the experts who decide where that line is. It is all of you who decide where that line is. And here's what you've heard as far as where the line is in this particular case. You've heard sort of an old school version of where the line should be, and you've heard the modern 2014 version of where APD drew the line in 2014 with its reactive control model. From our side, you've heard from two people about where the line is. SWAT Sergeant Jim Fox, who talked about the reactive control model and where the line should be, and Jeff Noble, Deputy Chief from California, who came in and talked to you about where that line has to be. And then on the other side, you heard from the defense expert, a fellow named Ron McCarthy. Our side talked about the reactive control model. You recall Mr. McCarthy talked about anticipatory shooting, is what he talked about. That that's where the line should be drawn. The police officer should be given lots of leeway. What our folks said was verbal threats are not enough for deadly force. No matter what somebody says to you, no matter if they curse you out, no matter if they threaten your life, words alone are not enough to kill someone. If you're going to kill somebody, it's not enough.
Sorry.
Sergeant?
I'm having a disruption in the audience. Sir, you're causing disruption. You're going to need to leave. Sorry for the interruption, Ms. McGinn.
It's all right, Judge. Okay? All right. You can't kill just to kill. You have to have a reason. That's it. That's it. Okay. And you can't do it just on words. What did Mr. McCarthy said? Well, he said, and he gave me an example. I think police officers should shoot whenever they feel threatened. And I remember the example he gave you about this fellow police officer on the beat, saw somebody walking up to him, he just felt wrong about it. The guy reaches under his sweatshirt and the officer blasted him. And it turned out, in that case, the officer was right. They lifted up his shirt and there was a gun that had been taken off the police who'd been killed the day before. And when I asked Mr. McCarthy, but what if they lifted up his shirt and it was a cell phone? Would you say that was still okay? And he said, yes, I would. I think of it as a sort of spidey sense rule for when police officers can shoot. And it concerns me because Mr. McCarthy is going around training people all around the country that if you just have a feeling, you can shoot somebody, and that's okay. And it's not. That's not what the Albuquerque Police Department was taught. What they were taught, according to Sergeant Fox and Jeff Noble, was that a weapon, particularly if it's a knife, is not enough. And that makes sense. It is, as much as they want to tell you, it's the same if you have a knife or a gun, they're both equally deadly. In fact, the statistics show, no, over 10 years where 598 police officers were killed, only 7 of those killings were with a knife. And the difference between a knife and a gun is if you can get a long way from me, but I can still shoot you from a long way away. But if you have a knife, as long as I create distance, I can protect myself and protect you too. What did Mr. McCarthy say? Mr. McCarthy said, you don't even need to have to ask if they would gain. I think you're doing something strange. I can just shoot you. I don't even have to see what the weapon is. I can anticipatorily shoot. And again, that's not the point. The one thing they agreed on was this, that the 21-foot guide does not apply if guns are drawn. That is, if the officers have their guns drawn. Both of them agreed on that. And we gave you a whole demonstration about the, I've probably heard enough about the Tooler drill, where you guys could teach a course on the Tooler drill. I think every single witness in this case talked about it. So if your gun is in your holster, this is the Tooler drill, you have to stay 21 feet away because it takes a second and a half for the person can get to you in a second and a half, all right? But if your gun is already drawn, you can, let me go back and do that again. You can move closer and you are safe even at 10 feet or less, because the bullet travels faster than the person. And with your gun out, if somebody comes at you with a knife, even if they take one or two steps, you have time to shoot the person. And so you can be close to them if your gun is drawn. And here, in this case, it's not just if your gun is drawn, you have a dog in between you too. So the person can't get you because there's a dog in between you. Whether the dog would attack or not, if Mr. Boyd came down, he would at least have to trip over the dog trying to get to anybody. The dog is right there. But that's what these officers were trained, not just from the Tooler drill, but this is actually from what the defense put on about how you are safe if you have your gun out at 10 feet. Hold on a second, Jess. Let me see if I can turn on my sound here. All right. This is from their exhibit on what these officers are trained.
For the average officer to deliver 2 rounds against an attacker who starts moving at 10 feet, the sidearm must already be drawn and ready to shoot.
So you can defend yourself at 10 feet. If you have your gun drawn at 10 feet, you are not unsafe. You are okay at 10 feet. That's what these officers are trained. I don't know if it bothers any of the rest of you, but it really bothered me that a lot of the examples they used were African-American people. It was a little disturbing to me, but this is the same, the African-American guy, and then you shoot the African-American guy. But what else about this line? Here's what Jim Fox and Jeff Noble both said. You have to have an attack. They have to not only have a weapon, have a threat, but they have to move towards you. And I think Jim Fox used the term, they have to be coming at you, is what he said. And here's where that comes from. By the way, McCarthy says, no, it's okay. I have a feeling. Nobody moves towards you. I can shoot you whenever I have a feeling. I can anticipate the attack, and I can shoot you if I anticipate the attack. Here is the document that you saw a lot too. This is the reactive control model. This is how all of these officers were trained. And this is what it says about what you have to have before you can shoot somebody, or what a reasonable officer has to have. You have to have, it doesn't say a step, it says you have to have an attack by the person. It's not enough that you have, this is all, this whole red zone is where you have been made threats and you have a weapon, but you still cannot shoot until they cross this line and there is an attack. And here's the other thing, closes distance. And that's not that the officer closes distance, that I'm the officer and then I run up on you and now you're a danger to me so I can shoot you. It is that the person comes towards you and closes distance on you, indicating that they're going to attack you. This is where the line was in 2014. That's where it was. No doubt, that's where it was. That's what Jeff Noble said. That's what Sergeant Fox said. This is where Mr. McCarthy wants to move it, maybe even further. I just feel I can shoot you if Mr. McCarthy's going to come in and defend some, a police officer who shoots based on a feeling about somebody that they might attack them. That can't be where it is. But you get to decide. You can decide if you want it over here that a police officer can shoot you if they feel like you're a danger, or you can put it back here where it belongs, where these officers were trained at the time, that it's not enough that somebody's threatening you, it's not enough that they have a knife, they have to actually come towards you and attack you in some way before you can fire. And even if you're within 10 feet, you've got plenty of time to shoot. And you're not in danger, even with your own 10 feet. Okay. Let me tell you what the case is not about before we get to Defendant Keith Sandy. This case is not an indictment of the Albuquerque Police Department as a whole. It is not. There are some good officers on the Albuquerque Police Department, and you've heard testimony from some. Jim Fox, I hope he comes back to APD. He is a fine, fine person. Michael Monette, a fine, fine officer. And even though the defense have asked you to judge Mr. Boyd on his past acts, you cannot judge APD on his past acts. That's not what this case is about. It is not about the dangers of the militarization of the police. Even though you've seen some elements of that here, it's kind of what do they use and the body armor. It's not about that. It is not about taking a stand about police violence in other cities or other places, or some of the things that you see on the news from cell phone videos. It's not about that. It is only about these two officers and what happened on March 16th of 2014. And let's start with Defendant Keith Sandy. Defendant Keith Sandy was one of the most dangerous kinds of officers you can have on the street. Somebody who was out there with something to prove, whether it was to regain his reputation, whether it was to show how tough he was, or whether it was something darker. I'll let you be the judge as to what was going on there. He's the kind of man who I think defense expert Ron McCarthy said had no business being a police officer. Because people who are out there not to do the right thing, not to protect people, are a danger not just to themselves, but to other officers and to every citizen. Defendant Sandy had been fired from the New Mexico State Police, you've now learned. And he was embarrassed by that. He was fired in 2007. And it was about the time that APD lowered its standards for lateral hires from other agencies. And so he was hired almost immediately back in to the police department at APD. And he worked his way to what I think he said in his statement was his dream job, that is not on the street, but as a tactical officer, a member of the ROPE team, the Repeat Offender Project. That is a group of men whose job it was to hunt down other men. And the men they hunted were repeat offenders, hardened criminals. It was a job that gave all of them, and you've heard some of this from the ROPE team, sort of a dystopian view, bad view of all humanity. And you heard this cynical worldview from Defendant Sandy. It is a worldview that caused them to think the worst about ordinary human interaction. So, when James Boyd threw a sandwich and a dinner roll to the dog, Defendant Sandy didn't see that as an act of kindness or giving food to the dog. He saw it, and this is, I think, his testimony. I thought he was gauging distance, seeing how far we were so we could do something or employ a weapon in some way. That's how he saw that. When Mr. Boyd put on a sweatshirt as evening neared because it was getting colder, it wasn't because he was getting cold, it was because he was trying to defeat somehow their less lethal devices. We asked if Defendant Sandy was he expressing fear, no, he never expressed fear that armed men and dogs around him would kill him. All he did was threatening. By the way, we have given you the transcripts, so I can just put that one side of this with, and I can't remember which one is which, I think it's yellow highlighted, is Mr. Boyd saying, I'm afraid you're gonna kill me, I'm afraid of you, I'm afraid of you, I'm afraid of you, and then in blue highlighting when he threatened the officers. So you can go through and look yourself and see, really it's about 80-20 at the beginning, and then as the TAC officers come up and get closer and closer to me, he becomes more and more, more threatened. These officers on the rogue team say, we believe his threats, but you can't believe him when he says he's gonna give up. You can't believe him when he says, okay, I'm gonna walk with you, I'm not gonna hurt you, I'm not a threat to you, I'm trusting you to keep your word. You can't believe him about that, but you have to believe him about his threat. And you can't believe him even when he turns. When they say, get on your ground and he turns, you can't believe that. What did Defendant Sandy testify on the stand that he thought he was doing? He wasn't surrendering. He was trying to flank us, to get around us somehow. And to try, the one guy with his two little pocket knives tried to take on all the 19 officers who were out there. That's what he said he was doing on the stand. What a person sees everybody as an enemy. Maybe the same kind of neighbor that sees a homeless person on the hill instead of offering him a sandwich or offering him help or calling the city to get their services, calls the police. And then after the police arrives, sets up a camera, two cameras on his balcony, and films the woman. From the moment he arrived, he and Sandy made a series of intentional decisions that led inexorably to the death of James Wolfe. What we set an opening is exactly what we're proving it for. This is the list of decisions that showed an opening. I will tell you, this is the only time we're here that Mr. Brigham is right about one thing. I was wrong about the initial call. And there's another thing, an opening that I was wrong about, and I'll tell you that when I get to it, okay? So here it is. I was right about the time. It happened at 5:23. And it wasn't that he heard the request. He gets a call from the radio, calls his phone, and asks him to bring a taser shotgun. He responds that he has one. It wasn't over the radio. It was a phone call. That is correct. And he tells, within 4 minutes, by the way, by 5:27, dispatch calls back and says, we've got the wrong guy. They don't want you. They want the gang unit. They don't want Rope to come out. They want you. They want the gang unit to come out. The taser shotgun. 4 minutes later, he says, cancel gangs, I'm coming. That's his decision to come. And then at 5:31, he calls his Rook Sergeant Ingram and asks him to call K-9, assembles a party of men with guns and dogs to go up into the mountains after James Ward. That's what he does. And then all of them get on rope air. We don't have a, wish I could give you a transcript of that phone call, not what they said. Whether they cursed on those calls or not, because they're not being taped. That one is not taped. But they have a conversation where he briefs them all, even though it's not his call out, even though he's not the sergeant in charge, he briefs them all and says, let's all meet there, these four men. Officer McFarland, K-9 Officer Weinerskirch, and Rick Ingram and him. And so they assemble this tactical team, and that's his decision to do that, to go up there after James Floyd. And then he grabs not just his taser shotgun, but he grabs his rifle. He arrives at 5:58, and down on the street, when he thinks he's not being recorded, he says while he's there, and no one said it. He uses the F word, calls him a lunatic, explains that to you by saying, well, I call everybody a lunatic, including my son jumping in the hay. I bet he doesn't call his son a deputy lunatic. And if he does, there's something wrong with the man. This is probably the best example for you of what his intent was that day. He says right there, I'm going to shoot him with his taser shotgun. He hasn't even seen him. Doesn't know anything about the call. That's what he says down there on the street. But he thinks no one is recording him and no one is listening. He then makes a decision to use his rifle as lethal cover. He decides to be lethal cover. And he trades off this taser shotgun, hands it to the other rope officer who already has a taser shotgun and has his rifle. And you've got the picture in evidence, and you can see where he's walking up there with two taser shotguns and his rifle. He chooses to be legal cover rather than use the taser shotgun. And then he says, and he didn't understand, I'm the one looking through my thing who says, I think these guys, these field officers who are up there, are too close and they're in danger. And I say to everybody else there, we've got to calm down, they're too close. And that's right, he wasn't the one to make the call, he didn't even have the authority, but he's the one that made the decision looking through the scope, these officers are too close. That is hogwash, and you know it's hogwash because that's that place where they were too close, that's the same place they end up when they go up there, that's the same exact place they go to. And there he is down looking through his rifle. You've heard how Mr. Boyd reacted to this. When, instead of Michael Monette, who was negotiating with him and talking about how he's going to get him out of the tower room, he's going to do things for him and try to get him off the mountain safely. When Michael Monette gets pulled down and Mr. Boyd sees these folks looking at him through rifles, checking him out up on the hillside, he becomes more and more agitated. Why are you putting rifles at me? This is where he starts saying, I think you're going to kill me. I think you don't want to care about my safety. You're going to kill me. And that all starts with, and by the way, it's not a surprise when they say, oh, does anybody think you, Mr. McCarthy? No, nobody ever reacts to the uniform. I'm sorry. Somebody shows up, like the life-size thing that you saw here, blow up with these guys with guns and hack military uniform. You're going to have a different reaction if it's some regular officer in a regular uniform. Even you are going to be intimidated by that particular outfit. What does he do next? Anthony Settle, this is the thing that was not on my list in opening, but we found it in trial. Anthony Settle, the SWAT officer, arrives and sees defendant standing looking at his through his rifle up there at Mr. Boyd, and he says, let me take over for you. Let me spell you, is what he says. And remember, Mr. McCarthy said, it was not a bad thing to call down Michael Monette because sometimes CIT officers get tired and it's okay to replace them with somebody else who can start over the negotiations. That's not what Michael Monette said. That was not the way it worked. You talk to the officers, are you making progress? You think you can make more progress? If so, I will leave you there because you're doing a good job. If you're not doing a good job, we'll call some other negotiator to help. Michael Monette is the person who has never failed to talk somebody down in this situation. Never, until now. And it wasn't his decision to come down. It was these folks down at the bottom of the hill calling him down because they said he wasn't safe. But when the same thing happened with Anthony Settler, when Anthony Settler came up to Keith Sandy and said, let me take over for you. He's a SWAT guy, not a rope guy. Keith Sandy says, no, I'll stay on lethal cover. Again, decides to stay on lethal cover. And now the interesting conversation that happened right before the SWAT team arrives. You've got these both transcripts, and I think you've also got the tape that you can listen to yourself. Here's the first one, where they stand in Weimerskirch and with Ingram standing there, discuss a plan, begin to discuss a plan in quotes because it was not a very good plan, and not because it's not everybody was on the same page of the plan. They talk about how the taser shotgun, we can't use both things. We can't use a taser shotgun and a dog at the same time. If we shoot him with a taser shotgun, because of this jellyfish thing, these wires that come off, what's going to happen is the dog's going to react badly to that and not bite because he can feel the shock, and that's how they're trained is with these shock collars, to not bite. And so they talk about that, and everybody supposedly in that, but the three of them knows you can't use both at the same time. And then, 10 minutes later, this is captured on air. Sergeant Weimerskirch, the cannon officer, seems to say, we've got less lethal tools coming. By the way, because they never talked to all the field officers who were there, they didn't know that there were already less lethal tools there. They already had two beanbag shotguns on premises. They already had two CIT officers on premises. They call for CIT and they call for beanbags, so they don't even know that they're there. And why are they doing this anyway? Because the person who's supposed to be in charge is Sergeant Carpenter. They're just sort of taking over the whole thing. Come in and just start making decisions and doing things without checking with Sergeant Carpenter or anybody else. And what Cannon Officer Weimerskirch says is, let's wait. We've got more less lethal tools coming. Let's wait for that and wait for more manpower. And one voice says, no, we can do it. We can do it. The three of them alone. And that voice is Pete Sin. That's who says that on that tape. At 7:16. And then the thing that changes everything happens. You think at that point they've made a decision not to go up. By the way, you have gotten instruction that you cannot consider the failure to use less lethal tools like the beanbag shotgun for the issue of justifiable homicide. You can consider their failure to wait on the issue of intent and what defendant Sandy was actually doing. Why didn't defendant Sandy wait for the beanbag shotgun? Why didn't he wait for more manpower? And by the way, McCarthy says there's nothing wrong with this. Even though the defense has argued there was something wrong, the canon officer made a mistake, their experts said nothing wrong. I'd let him do it the same way. And it's something completely different than what he testified about in a whole other case, where in the other case that he testified, he criticized them for having three men go into a arrest situation, a dynamic entry, when they had 10 men available. He was critical of them. He was also critical of them and said, this man in that case, the officer in that case, was not faced with an imminent threat. And how do I know that? Because all the shots that he shot did not come in the front of the man. They came in his side. Now that's what he said in the other case, something different than what he said to you today. Anyway, sorry, back to the story. 7:20, we all know what happens. Sergeant Fox arrives and he says, I'm here. And what does that mean? And what does every single one of them know that it means, all three of the men on this entry team? It means that they're not going to get to go do this arrest. Because when the SWAT team arrives, the SWAT sergeant takes over, and they replace them with SWAT officers who have trained together, who know how each other works, who knows what their plan is, and they know they're going to lose this arrest. And it is that moment that causes them to decide to go up next to where James Boyd is, right back to the place where they said those other officers were not safe. And it should be instructed to you on your intent, but they don't tell anybody what they're doing. Not only do they not tell anybody what they're doing, but their plan that they're supposedly conducting an arrest, there is none of the three of them that is assigned to go hands-on and arrest this man. None of them were assigned to arrest this man. Unlike the CIT officers, defendant Sandy wasn't there to help Mr. Boyd. He was there to hurt him, just like he sat down the street. Although they are two very different officers, and I told you that from the get-go, they are both charged with the same thing. Now that is second-degree murder. And let's talk about the UJIs that the court just read you. This is the second-degree murder instruction. We'll talk about the easy parts of this instruction, and we'll talk about the harder parts for the decision. All of these except for three, I think there's no dispute about it. These two defendants killed James Boyd. Both of the defendants knew that their acts created a strong probability of death or great bodily harm to James Boyd, and this happened in New Mexico on or about the 16th day of March. As far as intent is concerned, both defendants took the stand and said, it was my intent to kill him, or shooting center mass, with the understanding he suffered great bodily harm with the kind of weapons we use. We intended to. It wasn't a mistake, it wasn't an accident, so you have intent. So the question then is this, three, and we have the burden of proving this, again, not beyond all possible doubt, but only based on beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant did not commit an act of justifiable homicide by a public officer or employee, or in defense of another. Those are the two defenses that they were raising. We have to prove that did not occur. Let's talk about this one first, the justifiable homicide instruction. This is the element right here. There's two elements that you need to consider here. The other, I think, are not contested. Were these officers, at the time they killed James Boyd, overcoming the actual resistance that he was giving them, to the discharge of the legal duty to arrest him for the felony crime of aggravated assault on a peace officer. That's the first step. Okay. And here's the fact that the case that depends. You can't be resisting arrest unless you know you are under arrest. Not only did these officers all admit that they never told Mr. Zoll that he was under arrest, but as part of this ill-conceived plan that the three of them came up with, they were planning to trick him into coming down, so that they could attack him, coming down the mountain. And they did that after Sergeant Fox arrived at 7:20, and we played you five different clips. So we yelled, well, but we insisted that he give up his knife. We played you five different clips after 7:20 where they kept saying, well, come on, just grab your bags and come on down the hill. Grab your bags and come on down the hill. And they never said, and you've got to put your knives down. You have to put your knives away before him. You okay, Mr. Brady? Okay?
Yes.
Okay. Right.
I'm just making sure that there is the actual jury instruction.
Yes, I think it is. Let me know if it's not. Where was I?
Let me just remind you to talk to me.
I'm sorry, Judge.
Not okay.
They not only didn't tell me it was under arrest, they told him the opposite. They were trying to trick him. They told him, and for him to believe him after talking about it for 2.5 hours, that he was going to be allowed to come down and give him safe passage and have transcript of what he said to them. I'm trusting you. He picked up his bags. He didn't want much. He said, don't even have to put me up in a good hotel. You can put me up in a Motel 6. And that's for the advertising. Six companies. Put me up in a Motel 6. And the officer said, well, you know how you know that he was under arrest is when you can't leave. That's how you know, that's how somebody knows they're under arrest. They told him the exact opposite. You can leave. You can come down. We're going to give you a voucher for a hotel. That he heard was a lie to trick him into coming down so that he would count on him. So when, in all of this, was the first time that Mr. Boyd sort of realized that they were not telling him the truth, that really they were going to arrest him. When is it? They say to you it's the very first time that he says, that they say, get on the ground, which is right after the flashbang grenade happened. They threw the flashbang grenade, there's all this smoke. This is the first time I think this slide, exhibit 9E9, when Defendant Perry said, I told him to get on the ground. Well, first of all, flashbang just went off, get on the ground. He's still figuring out what the heck is going on. There's just been a giant explosion in his feet. The next time he tells him to get on the ground is here, when he is leaning forward to defend himself against the dog. And I suspect he's not getting on the ground when there is a dog running on him, whether he even heard get on the ground at this particular point, because he is defending himself against the dog, is anybody's guess whether he even heard it. And they say, they continue to say get on the ground, they say it two more times, and at some point, and watch the video, the most important evidence in this case is the video. When somebody tells you something, check it out. You can see the realization going on with the book. As they continue to say, get on the ground, get on the ground. And indeed, he pulled his knives out in response to the dog to defend himself against the dog. He has them out like this for about a half a second, and then he drops them to his sides, and that's where they stay. And you can see it dawning on him that they're not letting him go down the hill. They're not getting him up the hotel room. She's not going from up on the mountain to a better place. And now he has a decision when he realizes that they're arresting him and assaulting him. To fight? To flee? Or to do what they say? You can see him deciding that. And his decision is to say, don't make fun of me. Basically, you didn't keep your word, you betrayed me absolutely. And then he makes the decision to obey their order and turns. And he continues to turn until he goes down on the ground like this.
here's the thing about physical evidence, like a video, it cannot